afternoon. Call the Finance Committee together. It is Friday, January the 31st, and it's 1:32. Today we're going to continue with our overview of the departments. And the first presenter today is Commissioner of Department of Revenue. And with her is the Director of Division of Administrative Service. Commissioner, introduce yourself and your staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I am the Commissioner for the Department of Revenue, and it is my pleasure to be here to walk through the budget overview. To get us started, we have four primary divisions within the department.
Commissioner, just before you get started, I didn't take roll, so to speak.
Okay.
Okay. So today we have Representative Guerra, Representative Costello, Representative Osterman, Representative Wilson, and Representative Edgeman here at this time, and I expect more to come in as we go. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The mission of the department is very simple, actually. It's to collect, distribute, and invest funds for the public purpose. To do that, we have four primary divisions: the Tax Division, which enforces the tax laws of the state, collects and accounts for all tax revenues. We have the Treasury Division, which manages and invests state funds. The Permanent Fund Dividend Division, which administers the dividend program and distributes this annual dividend payment to all eligible Alaskans. And finally, we have the Child Support Services Division, which collects and distributes child support to custodial parents. Our results in 2013 was a very interesting year for the Department of Revenue, and it's nice to be able to talk about some of the things that I'm particularly proud of. First, the department's done a lot of work on the website to provide updated link and easy links to current fund balances and fund performance. We've also provided links to the status of the tax revenue management system and its implementation. So our goal is to try and provide as much information as we can about what is going on in the department so that you can easily access information as it's requested, whether it's child support and how that program operates, the permanent fund dividend and applying for that dividend online, or finding a document library on the More Alaska Production Act or the gas line as we go along. We have a newly established hosting a site just to contain a document library for that purpose. We've also undertaken, in conjunction with the governor's administrative order, a review and update of regulations, and we continue to look to make those regulations easier and more straightforward and understandable so that we can implement the statutes as we see fit, but also make it easier for compliance purposes on the part of those needing those statutes. Just to give you an idea of the changes in the department, in 2005, the department and the Commissioner of Revenue had fiduciary responsibility for $20.71 billion. In 2013, that is now over $49 billion. We've seen three major tax changes, along with additions of various taxes and tax credits, such as the film tax credit. And in that time, we've seen a growth of our budgeted positions of only 3.8%. So I think that the department has done a very good job in managing a lot of change very successfully. Moving on to specifically the Treasury Division, Alaska received its third AAA rating from Fitch in fiscal year 13, making it one of the few states that has a AAA rating from all three rating agencies. The fiscal year 13 returns for 37 out of the 39 funds managed by the Treasury Division exceeded the benchmark returns. PERS and TERS funds returned 12.5% and 12.59%, respectively, well exceeding the 8% goal set for those funds.
Representative Thompson, and Ben Yosef join us. Thank you. Representative Newman also.
Moving on to the Permanent Fund Dividend Division, the cost of reviewing a PFD application and paying the dividend declined each year between 2011 and 2013. Of the 139,000 eligibility cases created, 97% of them were contacted by the time the dividend amount was announced in September, and that allowed those applications to then be processed in time for those dividends. And that is a 7% better than the 90% contact rate we had in 2012. So we're really getting to those applications, getting them reviewed well before the dividend gets paid out. The division had the lowest number of cases, unreviewed cases ever recorded at the time of the dividend announcement, and only 3,900 cases remained under review at that point in time out of the total of over 600, almost 670,000 applications that came in. We also overhauled our technician training program, hiring a new trainer, which subsequently shaved a month off of our three-month training program. And this means technicians are working cases and fielding questions faster than ever, which also helped with our eligibility review. Moving on to the Child Support Services Division. The federally required self-assessment showed that the Child Support Services Division exceeded all federal requirements for the Child Support Program. We pulled out a couple of those that I think are really illustrative in this case. So in the paternity establishment cases that required action, we had 53 of those cases, and we were compliant within the time frames 92% of the time. With 49 of those cases. In the case of enforcement and disbursement, similar high percentage efficiency rates of complying and making sure enforcement actions are dealt with in a timely manner along with disbursement and medical support enforcement. More interestingly for myself was that Child Support Division was able to, in its second year of doing this, increased its teenage outreach program, making 70 presentations in 48 schools throughout the state. The tax division was given, the tax division received an appropriation in the 2011 session of a little over $34 million, $34.7 million to be precise, to implement a tax revenue management system. Phase one of that project is in its final stages and should be live for taxpayers to use starting in April of 2014, so just in a few couple of months. Less than 90 days, and will be rolled out for all corporate income tax filers as well as many of our excise tax filers. Phase two will be starting in the next few weeks, and this phase includes the oil and gas production tax, property tax, and economic research, and so that phase is expected to be completed in 2015. You can monitor the progress of the implementation on our website under the tax division. There is a link to the tax revenue management system. It also gives taxpayers notifications as to when they can expect to be able to use the system. We successfully drafted and finalized the regulation package within six to seven months of the passage of Senate Bill 21. So those regulations were in effect when the majority of the law took effect on January 1st, 2014. And we have taken care of filed regulations pertaining to interest rate calculations, and those were filed with the Lieutenant Governor as of last week, so we expect to see those come out shortly. And most importantly, 98.5% of known taxpayers filed their tax returns and made their payments timely. The Department of Revenue also has responsibility for four authorities and corporations under the umbrella of the department. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, which is to provide Alaskans access to safe, quality, and affordable housing. The Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, which is to maximize the value of the permanent fund. Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority, which provides municipalities with financing options for their capital projects. And I know that you'll be hearing from three of these separately. So if we look back at the department's activities, and I alluded this to a little bit earlier in my opening remarks, but the revenues collected by the tax division increased 58% over the last 8 years from $1.9 billion to $3.0 billion. There were multiple tax programs created. Secondly, funds under management. We increased funds under management from 20 billion to 50 billion. The number of permanent fund dividend paid to Alaskans increased from just under 600,000 dividends paid in fiscal year 05 to 640,000 in fiscal year, estimated for fiscal year 14, which is the 2013 dividend, and the implementation of Pick, Click, Give into that program during that time frame. The number of child support cases increased 4%, but the amount distributed to custodial parents increased by 15%. The chart on page 9 is an illustration of what the department has accomplished from 2005 to 2014 with the constitutional budget reserve funds and the general fund and other non-segregated investments. And we got into this when I presented the state savings account and the status of the savings account. But I think this just shows the tremendous growth in those funds that have occurred over the last, really the last 8 years. Moving on to other agency operations. And this was prepared by the Legislative Finance Division, but the Department of Revenue's budget has stayed within that 0.8 to 1% range of the total state budget for unrestricted general fund revenues only. And we've had pretty stable budgets over the last few years. As a percent by fund group, the lion's share, the changes here are due to the top, to the changes in federal receipts, and that's really towards the Child Support Services Division. And then the bulk of other state funds is the permanent fund and the retirement funds.
This is showing that same on the...
Yeah. On slide 12, we were showing the same information from slide 11, but by fund source, so that you can see more specifically how much is attributable to the permanent fund corporation and the pension funds versus general funds and federal funds. And when we look at it by program, the majority or the largest slice is actually for the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and the Permanent Fund Dividend Division, so outside the department, the department's base operations in this case. Looking at this, the Alaska retirement management that we do takes up approximately $51,946,000 of the department's budget, and child support services, of which we receive federal receipts for, is about $28,543,000. Any questions? Okay. At this time, what I'd like to do is turn it to Jerry Burnett to walk through the actual changes in the budget line items as proposed before you.
For the record, my name is Jerry Burnett. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Revenue. We don't have a lot of budget changes for FY15, and most of them are shown in red. The first one, the non-personal services reductions, were a result of the commissioner and myself with our staff going through all of our division's budgets, looking at places where we had external payments that we could avoid in the future, and surgically taking out an amount of each division. So the largest chunk of that, or piece of that, is in the Treasury Division. As it turns out, it's money that was in the Retirement Board funding for those general fund dollars to be used for non-pension trust related, so the defined contribution programs administration, and we found that over the years we need less and less each year of that. So The rest of it is small amounts taken out of all the divisions. We had, as you will see, I think, in every department's budget, some position deletions for positions that hadn't been filled in the previous fiscal year. We had four permanent full-time positions, a part-time and a temporary position, and the funding with those. And so those are in the tax division and the permanent fund dividend division. And the other small reductions there were reductions in rates charged for retirement. I mean, excuse me, not for retirement, for health benefits that are across the board to all employees, and working reserve reductions, working reserves being the amount that we pay the Department of Administration to hold for leave cash in and terminal leave. So that shows a total of around $1 million in reductions. And then the only one small increment in the department is $23,800,000. And that's permanent fund management fees, custodian management fees for the permanent fund because of their growing balance and the types of assets that the permanent fund is invested in. So it's pretty simple. Okay, in the capital budget, we're asking for a small computer replacement, which is an ongoing process. We replace on a four-year cycle all of the personal computers in the permanent fund dividend division, and the same thing in the child support division. These are divisions where it's all public contact, stuff that has to be done. So we have them on a specific cycle, and we've included the funding for that in the capital budget since 2004 on a regular basis. The other capital budget requests in the Department of Revenue are all in the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and we've listed the important parts of those: the weatherization, home energy rebate, homeless assistance program, supplemental housing development, the teacher health, public safety, VPSO housing loans, and the senior citizen housing development. And those numbers at the bottom don't total to the same as at the top because they have some other small requests that I didn't call attention to that are in the budget. But Alaska Housing will be speaking to you about this at some point in the future. And the rest of the slides are on our 10-year expenditure production projections. And if you look at this, we are increasing using a 2.5% inflation rate, and the external custody and investment management fees using anticipated rates applied to future market values. We're not increasing the permanent fund dividend division based on expected numbers of people that are going to be at work. You know, we don't assume that because you have more applications, you're going to need more money, for example. So we don't have those types. And I'll note that our assumptions, we don't include future contractual salary increases in any of the department's 10-year plans. So we have market expectations for APFC. We have the corporation's earnings resuming to pre-recession levels and annual contributions to the weatherization program. And if you look at our graphs, you can see that the commissioner mentioned we had a 3.2% annual growth in our general fund budget over the past 10 years, and about a 7% increase in our all funds budget over the last 10 years, which I think is lower than many departments. So going out to the future, you'll see a fairly low, shallow slope on our 10-year projections. There's a couple of graphs here that are that would show the continued budget growth from the past attached to ours. These were provided by a legislative finance division. And That does take into account such things as salary increases, et cetera, which our graphs don't show. So, and with that, I think we'll let the commissioner wrap up, and then you can ask us questions.
Thank you, Jerry. Just in terms of wrap up, just the tax division is actively engaged in improving the information system to ensure efficient tax administration, to more effectively serve our taxpayers in this state, and to provide timely access to information necessary for assisting policy decision makers and decisions contemplated by the legislature. Second, it's important to note that the Department of Revenue is the state's largest investment manager. We pride ourselves on prudent investment practices for a variety of programs and needs while achieving and maintaining the highest credit rating and thus the lowest cost of borrowing. Our customer service sections in the Permanent Fund Dividend Division and Child Support Services Division have continuously improved their business practices in order to provide increased service levels without increasing staff. And finally, our corporations have received national recognition for their exemplary program management and their fiscal solvency. And so with that, I'm happy to open up for any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'll start with a couple small ones here. On page 4, your second bullet there, you talk about the performance measures of 85% in your 12% above that. So is it time to change that measurement to force you to continue to improve?
Mr. Chairman, I think it is probably time that we can discuss about what the appropriate measurement is, if it's 80, you know, I think technology has really helped us. Not only has it helped us, but I think we've seen over the years that Alaskans have gotten much more comfortable with applying online. I think we're at 86% right now in this filing season of online applications, and that's allowed us to really address many issues early on. So I think there probably is we can look at this benchmark and see if there isn't a more appropriate benchmark.
On page 6, your bottom sentence, 98.5% of the known taxpayers. What that implies that you there are unknown taxpayers out there that you know how many of there are. If they're unknown, how do you know there are unknown ones?
Mr. Chairman, that's an interesting question, because I'll tell you from my own standpoint how I view it is that when I worked outside and established a business, I talked to an attorney, talked to an accountant, and relied on their advice that I had to get a business license, that I had to file these income tax returns, that I had to do these things, and I set that up as a business owner. And those are the people we know about, the people that have come in. We have a criminal investigatives unit so that when we get tips where people see violators of whether it's child support, whether it's permanent fund dividend fraud or tax fraud, we then have an opportunity to investigate those potential cases and make a determination whether or not there is actual fraud going on. But we can't know, we can't know if somebody is out there running a business and not complying with us and not getting, if they have, maybe they didn't get a business license, for example. They're doing something, they didn't get a business license. So we rely on the Department of Commerce and Community and Economic Development and their business licensing units to reconcile our records. And we try and do a lot of coordination at the state level. But of the taxpayers that we're aware of, 98.5% of them filed timely and made their payments.
Good. Questions? Representative Thompson.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here today. Also on page 6, back in 2011, the legislature appropriated $34.7 million for the tax revenue management system, which you say is now getting implemented and is about ready to go online, and it's going to be streamlined even further. Is this going to save us personnel costs in the future? Is this going to streamline what we're doing, and where are we with that?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, I think it's too soon to say just what that will look like right now in terms of actual staffing levels. I think what it is going to allow us to do, though, is to really examine our process and make sure that we are placing auditors where there's the most value and doing the things that we need to do to make sure that taxpayers are in compliance and that the state is receiving the revenues it's entitled to. I think that there's been a lot of, you know, we have 22 different tax types. We focus the majority of our resources on oil and gas production tax because that is the lion's share of revenue to the state. But there's a lot of work that we need to be doing on the other tax types as well, whether it's tax collection or tax credits. And so while the tax revenue management system is certainly going to help us with information and data and understanding who's in compliance and who's not, I'm not prepared to say it's going to allow us to cut staff at this time.
One other question that people would probably like to hear also. Oil taxes, we're now into our third with SB 21, which is just started in January 1st. We're still not audited into the ACES yet. That's another system. And you've got one prior that you haven't completely caught up on, that regime of different taxes we have. Should the SB 21 be rolled back in August at the vote, you'll have 9 months of SB 21. You've still got ACES going on, and you'll have to go back to ACES. Is that going to cost the state a lot of money to roll back to the ACES after going into the SB 21? And what's the cost going to be to the state for changing gears in the middle of the stream?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, a couple of things. So 2007 was a year in which we had a partial PPT and partial ACES tax year. That tax year is rapidly being finalized. It will be done by March 31st, 2014. So the 2008 through 2009 tax years, those audits are already well underway, so we are auditing ACES in those tax years. Those first filings came in March of 2008, the first ACES filings really started coming in March 2008. If the referendum passes and SB 21 is rolled back, we will have again a split tax year of 9 months and 8 months and 4 months. And we are programming the tax revenue management system for SB 21 because that is the current law, and our expectation is that that gets rolled out. We will have to go back, and we will be back in 2015 for a supplemental to undertake that cost of having to reprogram for a partial year along with programming for ACES, which we're currently not doing because it is not the current tax law. I don't have a specific dollar amount for what that'll cost.
No idea.
We'll do some research into that for you, Representative Thompson.
Thank you.
Commissioner, you just mentioned completing the tax year 2007 by March. So is 2006 the most current tax year that is complete for audits and everything?
Mr. Chairman, if by complete you mean we are no longer looking at anything related to that tax year, that is correct.
It just jumps in your mind. It's 2014, and so time frame between now and 2007, how much, I mean, is this a normal? I mean, is this a normal state way of doing business?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, so 2006, I mean, they don't have to be filed till March of the following year. So we are looking at, in March of 2014, of getting their tax returns for calendar year 2013. Okay, so there's a lag on that. But I think it's really important to note that the oil and gas taxpayers are required to file monthly filings with the state. They're required to make monthly payments, estimated tax payments on that. And so the audit for the year is really just making sure that what they said for the year is consistent with what they have been saying every month. And we review those monthly filings every month when those come in. So I have tremendous confidence in the staff within the tax division that we are on top of what is happening. Do we have the final audits done for the complete year? No, that is correct. That is not being done. But I think that given all the changes that have happened over the years, I think the staff has done the best that they can. And I feel confident in the revenues that we've collected, that we have seen. And all of this is also being done as the taxpayers are filing their federal filings, and we use those as benchmarks as well.
Does this paint a picture that we've underfunded staff for Department of Revenue for years and put you in a position where you're not? I'm not a tax person. I don't sit and listen to you guys all the time, so I don't know whether this is normal or whether it's not. I'm just asking the question.
Mr. Chairman, I know that the requests for an updated revenue management system in some of the positions began with the passage of ACES. And in the case of the revenue management system, that funding didn't happen until 2011 for probably a variety of reasons of which, you know, I was not here for. But we did get the funding in. We are working very diligently on getting the revenue management system up and running. And I think that once we do that, we'll be able to catch up on these audits, and we'll have to deal with, you know, with it going forward as to how that works. But, you know, I don't know if it.
Okay, well, to answer this question, what's your anticipation once this new management system is up and running and working, that does it move it from 5-6 year out up to a 2 year? Or,
yeah, our work plan, Mr. Chairman, is to cover 2 years in one audit. So an auditor will take a two-year piece rather than a 1 year and a 1 year, and do one audit on a full 2 years, so that we'll be able to catch those time frames up with the new system.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Commissioner. I'm on page 3. And my question is going to regard on how the state invests the funds that we currently have, whether it's the Constitutional Budget Reserve, statutory, TERS and PERS funds. TERS and PERS will be a fairly active discussion this year, and I see your calculations say the returns of around 12.5%, and if memory serves me, when I read the revenue book, that's a five-year average. I think this last year was about 15%, or is this a one-year average, a five-year average, or is this latest return on this?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, this was the real return for fiscal year 2013. So this was on June 30th, 2013, as of June 30th.
What I'm trying to get, Commissioner, is, if I may, Mr. Chair, what I'm trying to get, Commissioner, is a long term. We're going to be dealing with this issue for a while. There's a again, legislation that would make substantial changes to this. So I'm trying to look back in history on investments that the state's made on behalf of the Tourist Purse Fund. Stock market crashed pretty good here a few years ago. If we were to go back and do a 10-year average on the amount of return, where would that be?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, we would be looking at something closer to 7%. And we did do some historical look backs from the time that the PERS and TERS were created. And the we have a 28-year calculation, so that's basically been the life of these trust funds. And the 28-year return was about 7.78%, not including the fiscal year 13 final results, because that number was calculated before this year was able to be rolled in.
I thought the revenue sources book put it at about a little less than 2% if you did a 10-year average, but I think that's what the revenue sources book had. But
not through the chair, Representative Newman, not on the PERS and TERS.
I'm glad to see a 7%, but when we have discussions that are the assumption that we're going to have an 8% rate of return on future investments by TERS and PERS, and you're telling me that we have an average of 7%, I have a concern there. And that was where I'm trying to get at is the investments of the state. We've been told some numbers of an average of 8%. Now historically we've had a 7%. My feeling is we'd be better to be on the conservative side of the world. If there's more money, that's a wonderful thing. That was my question. So any response to why or how you do those investments and why you feel to be secure would be welcome.
Through the chairman, Representative Newman, the actuary assumes an 8%, which is a real return of approximately, doing math in my head here, of about 6% in inflation of around 2%. So there's an inflation factor built into that 8%. And one of the things that will happen is that as we adjust those assumptions going forward, we're going to affect what the health of the pensions trust funds look like. And what we do within the Department of Revenue and the Treasury Division is we set an asset allocation based on targeting that 8% return. And as you can see, in 2013, we beat that target with the asset allocation we had. And in other years, like 2009, we had, I think it was close to a 20% loss. So it takes a long time to make those up. In any regard, our goal is to invest in such a way so that the assets are there to make the benefit payments as required by the trust. And we will continue to do our fiduciary responsibility to review that asset allocation and make sure that it is appropriate to the timing and the use. And quite honestly, we do that and take that very seriously for all the funds we have under management, whether it's statutory budget reserve or constitutional budget reserve or power cost equalization fund. But to live within the statutory mandates that we are required to, as well as fulfill my fiduciary responsibility to protect that principle and to increase revenues to the state to the extent it is prudent and feasible.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and I appreciate the work that you've done on this, and a good look at how greater risk, is going to provide probably a better opportunity on return, but long-term is it, relevant there, and so we'll get into the discussion. I just wanted to get some concept of where the commissioner was at. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on Representative Osterman's questions, and Ms. Rodella, you're new, you have nothing that's happened in the past has anything to do with you. But I'm worried about the ACES audits. I've said this since I've been on this committee, that we haven't had enough auditors. And I've always been promised we're just on the way to getting that first audit done. And it's now 2014, and we haven't gotten the first audit done. And I've been assured by members who've disagreed with me, we have enough auditors, and I lost that argument. But here's the problem. Conoco, I feel fine for them, just reported they earned roughly $2 billion in profits last year in Alaska. The other companies don't reveal their Alaska profits, but say they earn roughly the same as Conoco, but they don't share them as directly. So it's about $40 or $50 billion of profits right now under ACES that we haven't audited. And what can you do to assure me that you have enough auditors to do a very intense audit of each one of these tax returns, especially for the big three oil companies? It's about $50 billion worth of profits since ACES has been there. That we haven't audited. And what concerned me was we haven't audited the first year, and then you mentioned, but you can explain this to me, and we're on track to start auditing all the rest of them. And if the first one's taken so long, how are the other ones going to be audited so quickly? So please comfort us that you have the staff to fully audit all of those tax returns, because if I'm a sophisticated company, sophisticated companies sometimes deduct things that shouldn't be deducted or ask for credits for things that they shouldn't get credits for. It's a financial incentive that, mm-hmm. that those in business sometimes have. So what can you do to comfort me?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett. No, I appreciate the question. And the legislature has been helpful in getting us the positions that we needed where we needed them. So in fiscal year 13, for fiscal year 14, you added another master auditor in oil and gas, and we added another oil and gas production auditor. So we have filled both of those positions, so we've added two additional audit staff to that. I think that as we go through these auditors are collecting data daily, monthly, on the oil and gas companies. Those companies are making payments, and the penalties for underpayment are significant to them. We are seeing their federal tax filings. We are able to go through on a monthly basis and do a review of that information. The final audit that we talk about, have we completed the 2008 audit because they've submitted their final year-end filing, is really what we're talking about here. As when it's my understanding, and I wasn't here, so if I misspeak, Jerry will elbow me, I'm sure, and correct the record. But it's my understanding that when ACES passed, there was a lot of work that had to be done over the regulations, and the monthly filings had to start coming in immediately. So there's been a number of amended filings based on the changes in regulations that occurred. The regulation packages did not finalize under ACES until 2 years after ACES passed. So it's very hard to tell a company it's got to pay X when we kept changing or changed the regulation. So there were amended returns as we went along. Now I think that all of that has been settled. The forms are done. The companies, the taxpayers know what's expected. And we have seen enough information that we have confidence in the amounts that are being paid. And just to give you an example, in fiscal year 11, based on the desk audits, we assessed $82.5 million in additional tax collection based on an overall collection of $4.5 billion, which is an indicator to us that there is very close compliance with both the tax and the tax credit. So I don't know Representative Guerra, how else to assure you, but I can tell you sitting here in what I've learned since becoming commissioner, I have a lot of confidence that the staff is working very hard to get this in place and or to get these audits finished and get the tax revenue management system in place and do the things they need to do, because they're interested in making sure that the state gets every dollar it's entitled to as well.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. And just two questions. I think I heard you saying in one specific year so far you found $82 million that were underpaid. If I misunderstood that, tell me. But just assure me that assure all of us that you are looking at all of the deducted and credited expenses to make sure that they're proper. I don't blame the companies for waiting for the regulations to come out, and same thing is going to happen under SB 21. It's going to take a while for the regulations to get finalized. But so I don't blame them. I just want to make sure we make sure each of those expenses was properly deducted or credited so that we get all the money that we're entitled to, because we're in a fiscal hole, and we can't afford not to audit.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, two things to that is the way we've divided the workload right now within we have 18 oil and gas production tax auditors. That group is roughly divided in half, with half focused solely on deductions and credits and half on tax collection. So we are devoting just as much resource, arguably, to making sure that the checks being written out are as looked at as hard as the checks being received on the tax front. I am pleased to report that the SB 21 regs are completed, and they were completed in time for the start of the tax year on January 1, 2014.
Thank you.
I'm glad you said that, because that was my next question, was how you're doing on regs, because I know 2008, 2009, we ran into the same thing with some fishery credit deal where it took basically 2 years to get the regulations written. Mm-hmm. So you're up to speed on that. Good. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on the same subject before I go to something else. So you were talking about the monthly audits, and they're pretty good, but what's the difference between the monthly audits and the cumulative year-end audits? Are you finding significant differences there? Is that making it easier?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, we are not finding significant differences from the year-end, from the monthly, and it does make it easier for us to do the year-end, having looked at all the monthly audits up to that year-end filing.
Okay, so and all of the master auditors are on task. They're all working on things that they were hired for. And
through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, they are on task. They are also on task with assisting the programmers on the tax revenue management system and making sure the revenue management system reflects both regulation and statute.
If I may, on page 14, you talked about these are cuts and non-personnel cuts, and I was wondering if the non-personnel cuts for external expenditures, are these going to show up as small increments in other places where you're assuming responsibilities that were done externally?
No.
Okay. And then on 15, the perpetual problem for all of us is computer replacements. It seems like there's a world of scheduling that we should do for upgrades and, you know, in computers. Is that built into your system, or is it always just coming back every couple of years for replacements?
Through the chair to Representative Guttenberg, we have these two divisions on an absolute cycle, on a four-year replacement cycle, so that you simply replace a quarter of your equipment every year. And our department, you know, it's all Windows 7. Everything is up to date. You know, we were probably one of the first departments that had everything kept up to date on that, because we can't have, you know, a person in the middle of getting that child support case done. You know, there's a short time window, mm-hmm. and immediate feedback. And PFD, of course, is immediate feedback to everybody if we can't keep up with things. You know, it's the world feeds back to us. So we make sure that those things are always on task and that their equipment's always working properly.
That's okay. I don't want to micromanage too much. Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, Commissioner, thank you very much, Jerry. Appreciate it. We will take up the Department of DNR now.
So Jerry's still on Windows 7.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
I'm told not to go to 8, so.
Okay. I think we can, well, we can ask our lead geologist to say,
can't go to 8 in an office.
It's Steve. Did they go back to English? Or you still don't know?
Well, the plan was booked today. Seattle, Juneau.
Right.
So when they weren't going to be able to fly in Juneau, everybody get off.
He could be building pipes.
Good afternoon, Commissioner.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Introduce yourself and staff and go ahead and make your presentation and we'll take up questions at the end.
Great. For the record, my name is Joe Balash. I am the Commissioner Designate for the Department of Natural Resources. I'm joined here by my Admin Service Director, Ms. Jean Marie Davis. We've got this presentation for the committee broken down into two parts. I will speak to the general overview slides, and then in the second half, allow Ms. Davis to speak to the specific numbers and components and various slides that we understand were requested by the committee for this afternoon's overview. Since this committee last met in April of 2013, there have been some changes to our org chart, mostly just the names. My predecessor departed. I was promoted to the commissioner's spot and backfilled my position with Mr. Bob Swenson. He's formerly the state geologist and ran the Division of Geologic Geophysical Survey. All of the direct reports remain the same between himself and Mr. Ed Fogles, the other deputy. And what we have identified here are the divisions and offices that are major components of our total operating budget. What's not identified here are the various boards, advisory boards that function within or alongside some of these offices. The department's mission is pretty straightforward. We're inspired by the Constitution. We're obligated to uphold that in the way we conduct our business and do it every day. Our core services, we've broken down into four main parts. We worked through a change in this overall structure with Representative Costello a couple of years ago in the way we structure our budget. But number one, we foster responsible commercial development and use of our land. Two, we provide access to that land for the benefit of the public. Three, we ensure sufficient data acquisition and assessment of our land so we know what we have, we know how to maximize the value of that land for the benefit of the people. And number four, we mitigate threats to the public. Most notably, you see that in the way we handle and respond to fires, but we also do work through DGGS to identify hazards around the state, whether it be fault lines and other areas that are susceptible to seismic activity, but also in our coastal areas, working with communities to identify sustainable locations in those instances where we see a need potentially for relocation. We are the primary land manager for the state of Alaska. As a land-rich state, it's a pretty big piece of property. We have 100 million acres of uplands, 60 million acres of tidelands, shorelands, and submerged lands. Another 40,000 miles of coastline. It really is
an astounding responsibility. We have incredibly gifted resource managers throughout our department, more than 1,000 employees who help us manage the task of administering all of our rules, regulations, and complying with the statutory direction that this body's given us to take care of this incredible bounty. Alphabetically, the first division I'll speak to is our Division of Agriculture, headed by Ms. Francie Havemeister. Their offices are located out in the Mat Su, just over 45 full-time employees. We also have the Division of Forestry, headquartered up in Fairbanks, although that's where the director, our state forester, Chris Mache, lives and operates out of. We also have a significant presence in South Central. Someday I hope we have an equally significant presence in Southeast, but that's a story for another day. Division of Geologic Geophysical Survey is located in the center of the universe, Fairbanks. We have Acting Director Steve Masterman headed up there while we cast our net looking for the next state geologist to replace Mr. Swenson. For some time, he and his predecessor came out of the energy side of DGGS. We're going to be looking for somebody to come out of the mineral side. That's going to be our preference going into the search. We think it's time to turn over that particular lead and get some real strong emphasis on the hard rock side of things. Our Director of Mining, Land, and Water is Brent Goodrum. He oversees more than 200 personnel in multiple locations throughout the state. He's been doing yeoman's work on our associated backlog while maintaining the pace of increased pace of authorization applications that have been coming in the door. And we've got some specific performance metrics to show you on that. At Oil and Gas, Bill Barron is a 30-year industry vet who oversees more than 100 people to administer our leases, ensure that we are collecting full value for our royalty, and also ensuring that we get compliance out of lessees to explore and develop the leases that they have as a matter of contract with the state of Alaska. Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation, Mr. Ben Ellis, is an enthusiastic director. I think he does more with less than virtually anybody else in state government. You know, we have the largest state park system in the country and I think one of the smallest state budgets. I think Ben does a fantastic job for us. One aspect of his office that is not necessarily obvious from the title is the Office of Archaeological History. They do a number of things relative to the permitting system overall, Section 106 compliance in particular, that's necessary as a key piece of developing our resources in a land where people have lived for tens of thousands of years. Number seven is our support. Ms. Davis and the admin service section split between here in Juneau and Anchorage. They maintain all of the information infrastructure that helps all of those previous divisions do their job. They do a fantastic effort for us and very pleased with the results, especially when we need to shake extra dollars free. In our offices, we start with the Office of the Commissioner. We have 10 positions budgeted full-time, presently have 9 of those filled. We also have the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office, and Ms. Allison Iverson is the director there acting. And they do a pretty important job for us as a landlord. Anytime a pipeline is going to cross our land, there's a specific section of our statutes that governs the right-of-ways and that are granted. And so in that regard, the SPCO functions not only as a landlord and rent collector, but in many ways also as a regulator. And it's a difficult balance to strike between that regulator job and that active landlord job. So the work they do reaches out across all of the state agencies. They actually bring in liaisons from the other departments, public safety, DEC, Fish and Game, and they do great work there. Our Office of Project Management and Permitting, these are the rock stars of permitting in state government. They operate on an MOU basis where applicants actually come in and provide funding for the extra service they provide. They coordinate reviews, typically for very large projects, but not always very large ones. And importantly, the applicants aren't always private industry. Sometimes it's other state agencies, and in particular DOT. A unique feature of the Department of Natural Resources is the Mental Health Trust Land Office. Many of you are probably familiar with the work of the Mental Health Trust Authority. The way that they fund their programs is through the development of land that they own here in the state. We have a unique agreement with the trust to establish and run the land office. These are all DNR employees, but they have a slightly different mission when it comes to making decisions on how to use the land. They are in it for the money. There are certain public interest considerations that they don't have to consider, like Division of Mining, Land and Water, or some of our other offices. Some key performance measures. What we have here on this slide 13 is an illustration of the increasing dollar value of MOUs that we have in our Office of Project Management and Permitting. I mentioned that they are basically funded on a customer service oriented basis. And this graph, I think, does an excellent job of illustrating how a division or office in this case that functions and provides a service that's in high demand grows more demand. In particular, we're seeing an uptick in the use of OPUMP by oil and gas companies. It has its origins in the mining industry, started off as the large mine project team, and ultimately grew to the status it holds now. The office is in need of some additional personnel. We try to stay ahead of the incoming tide and make sure that we do have enough professionals on hand to keep up with the workload as it comes in the door. The Division of Mining, Land and Water, at the transition in 2010, we encountered a backlog of requested permits, authorizations, and other assorted filings in the Division of Mining, Land, and Water that exceeded 2,600 in count. With the very eager cooperation and assistance of the legislative bodies, we have been able to fully staff up the division, and with the assistance further of some statutory modifications, we have been able to work the number down steadily each and every year while also seeing an uptick in overall activity. Similar to the Office of Project Management and Permitting, there's been an uptick in demand for authorizations in MLW. So in some ways, the job they've been doing is fixing an airplane while it's in flight. And the fact that they've been able to do it and make progress each and every year is something that's a real credit to Director Goodrum and the approach he's instilled in his division. Slide 15 is a very interesting one. This is an effort to measure our timeliness in issuing oil and gas leases following a sale. And for years and years, the standard had been, following a sale conducted either in the spring or in the fall, that the leases themselves would actually be issued within 9 months. And for many years, that was the norm. And in 2012, we ran into a problem. And it was kind of a big problem. We didn't miss the target by much. It was just a few weeks. But it caused us to undertake an evaluation of our entire process of issuing the leases after a sale. And I'm pleased to report that following the fall sale, this in 2013 for the North Slope, all of the leases were issued within 7 weeks. Director Barron and his staff did a top-to-bottom review, examined their processes, and found a number of ways to get the job done faster and smarter. And before we modify the target, Mr. Chairman, we want to see how things go in the Cook Inlet sale, make sure that we're able to achieve similar results before we hold ourselves to a different standard. Slide 16 is an effort to track how quickly we get the data published after our folks at DGGS go out and collect it. What we have found over the years is that when the results of the airborne geophysical surveys are published, we see a pretty significant uptick in mineral claims and exploration activity in said area. I'm a big believer in the contributions that mining can make to local communities. I grew up in the interior and saw firsthand what Fort Knox did for the community in providing incredibly well-paying jobs to support families comfortably in the interior, and it's something that I think we need to replicate as far and wide as we can in the state. Finally, park fee revenues. You know, one of the things that I mentioned earlier, we have one of the largest, we have the largest state park system in the country, and what we know is that with the exception of a couple of heavily used parks by outside visitors, most of our parks are enjoyed by Alaskans. This is a service that we provide to the people who live here, and they pay the service fees associated with camping, launching their boats, and otherwise enjoying the great outdoors. This is one of the quality of life issues that we're happy to help provide Alaskans on a daily basis. And you can see that we've had a nice uptick in 2013. We think that the opportunity for park fee revenue is certainly out there. Alaskans are willing to pay for the services they get in those parks, but you know, there is a little bit of a tension, a balance between increasing those fees and Alaskans getting something that they already own, quite frankly. So I think that concludes the part one, and as we move into part two, Ms. Davis will walk us through the numbers, and when we come back for questions, I think either of us will be able to answer on both parts.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jean Davis. I am the director of the Support Services Division for DNR. And just to start out and show what we have across all the divisions and offices that Commissioner Balash talked about, are about 1,100 employees. Our primary offices are located in Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks, and Palmer, but we have employees in 32 locations around the state. And this is a graph you're most familiar with. Legislative Finance has provided this graph for us. The things that we would like to show or point out on the budget growth analysis, Department of Natural Resources is in 2006, 2.63% of overall agency general fund budgets, and in FY15 budget we will be 2%, so a slight downtick from the overall. I believe that the statewide growth, annual growth rate in the last 8 years for all agencies has been 7.2%, and as identified in the box on the left, DNR's growth rate is about 2.6%. We have had a few changes in our budget. You'll see an uptick between the FY8 and the 9 management plan, and we've attributed that to, in the FY9 budget, a recognition for the workload that was being undertaken in the oil and gas division. So some of our oil and gas folks got increments there, and that was also when AGEA and some of the gas line-related appropriations started. And in addition, we had $1 million added to our budget that year to support the increased aviation contracts for aviation for firefighting. The other kind of slope up that we see is between FY11 and through FY14, and I attribute that to the support this body has had primarily for our Division of Mining, Land, and Water, and the increase in some funding to support and fill vacant positions, a few new positions, in the effort to reduce the backlog that Commissioner Balash addressed there. In addition, we've had funding to support RS-2477 navigability work, ongoing litigation, and increased money to Department of Law, stewardship, and in the agricultural program, horticulture program. This slide, number 21, is also a legislative finance slide. This just shows our all funds, the percentage across the years. For us, it's a rather unremarkable slide. We have a slightly less amount in our general fund than we did. Our federal receipts are identical, 13% of our budget in 06 and 13% in 15. The slight increase that we've seen in the other state funds, those are the statutory designated program receipts primarily, and those are the industry funds that support our OPUMP and our state pipeline coordinator's office, and our mental health office also falls into the other funding source category. We take a look at the 10-year growth slide. What that shows is the green line is the continuation of the 2.6% of our annual growth rate, and the dotted black line is what we've entered into our 10-year fiscal plan as things that we would like to be considering going forward. What we do is have all of the divisions evaluate workload, look ahead, try to look at the trends, see where the issues are, and we build into that. We do pretty well taking a look for the first 3 to 5 years. I think after that, it flattens out significantly. And I should have noted, the first slide was general fund only. This slide is the same slide, but with all funding sources brought together. Commissioner Balash discussed the four core services that help us meet our mission at the beginning of the presentation. And on the right side, you see our FY15 governor's budget broken out in percentage as to how much goes towards each of our core services. And just for comparison, we've shown the FY13 actuals, the year we just completed, and how we actually spent. And I would like to just draw the attention to the purple, which is the mitigate natural hazard threats. This makes it really clear that when we have a large fire season and a large fire year, a higher percentage of our budget is actually spent on fire. And so that tends to skew budget comparisons from year to year when you're looking at them. We move to the next slide to show you what our budget looks like by fund source broken down. But I'd like to note at the note at the bottom, we've removed the fire activity, both the budget from the 15 and the actuals from 13. And then you can see how the funding sources, undesignated general fund, designated general fund, other funds, and federal are fairly track fairly well. This is a snapshot of our 2015 budget request, broken out by division or by office. The largest chunk by far there is the Division of Forestry at 27.6%. But I'd like to point out that of that, the fire suppression piece of that program is 23.7%. The forest management, forest resources piece itself ends up being about 4% of the overall budget. The next two slides are a little bit small, a little bit busy, but I think it walks you through how we get from how we got from our FY14 current year management plan budget to our 15 request. The governor's budget uses the FY14 management plan as the base. Legislative finance then breaks out all of our transactions that we submit to them and identifies some transactions that they put into the FY15 adjusted base. So where there are one-time appropriations that were made in 14, they remove them from the adjusted base so that they are not skewing what the new money is. And where there are opportunities, where there are costs that are basically for providing the same level of service, such as the contractual salary increases, those are also backed out for comparison's sake. So what we've shown you is our management plan on the left side, broken out by core service and by the four categories of funding, and then the FY15 adjusted base on the right side. The net reduction is $3,086,000, and then the bottom portion shows you what that's made of. There's the key changes that identify those statewide contractual salary increases and the health insurance and working reserve rate reductions. Multiple one-time items that are reversed, and then we had a transfer of one position from Department of Transportation into our budget, and that is a net zero to the state bottom line, so it becomes an adjusted base. This next slide just really shows you where we end up. We start with adjusted base on the left and end up in the governor's budget on the right. You'll see that that is a reduction of $1.6 million. That $1.6 million is then identified by our key changes on the bottom portion of the slide. Really, the top two entries there on the key changes are deletions in our budget, deleting the gas pipeline project office as we transition out of AGEA, and deleting long-term vacant positions, and that is, a statewide effort. The next two items we show there are restoration of items that were appropriated in 14, but they were appropriated as one-time items, so they were backed out of the budget, and then we are asking for them to go back in. The next three items beyond that are really our key general fund increases that we are asking for this year. We are looking to partially fund existing and vacant positions for our field operations staff for parks and to get the South Denali implementation started. Our second request is a geologic materials center. We will be occupying that in September, and we will are asking for money to with the utilities and lease payments to the Department of Administration. And the third item is in the Office of Project Management and Permitting. As Commissioner Balash mentioned, we're asking for another position to support oil and gas workload per request for coordination, as well as federal resource planning review, and the remainder of those are changes that we do have in our budget related to other funding sources and some technical reductions. So we've looked at the expenditure side of our budget. I'd like to finish the slides today with a look at our an average annual revenue generation. This is over the time frame from FY 2006 to 2013, and compared to our average unrestricted general fund budget. So the red piece of pie that is sticking out of the pie is our average over that time frame of what our operating budget was for unrestricted general fund. The remainder, it shows the revenue that DNR collects, accounts for, deposits on an annual basis, which is $2.6 billion to either the unrestricted general fund, to the permanent fund, to the constitutional budget reserve fund, and to a mix of other funds such as the mental health trust, the school fund, the ARLF interest, and additional receipts that we collect from the recording offices and from the state pipeline coordinator's office lease revenue. And I believe with that, we would be in conclusion and ready for questions.
All right, thank you very much for the presentation. Let's go to page 14 to start with. When we had this conversation about the number of permits that were outstanding in 2011 and put that funding in, the conversation also dealt with the business aspect of how long it took to get a permit to go into business. So what does the new numbers on 2014 of 1,237 permits mean for a time frame to apply for a permit, and particularly, you know, like docks and wetlands and stuff like that? Because we were, some distances 5 years out for somebody. The department was telling people, in 5 years we might get it because we've got 2,500 in front of you. So,
Mr. Chairman, there's a variety of things going on with this number and the dynamics that affect it change year over year. My understanding is that we have achieved a rather high percentage of processing of applications that come in the same year. And so what we're constantly doing is beating back the backlog, but also adding to it. And so we've got sort of a dynamic in and out approach there. In terms of the cycle times associated with those authorizations, I think we can certainly provide metrics in a variety of ways, but these are rolling up all of the mining, land, and water activities that go on. I think the APMA paperwork that comes in, the number exceeded 750 last year. And so that's an example of a particular authorization or piece of paper that runs through the Division of Mining, Land, and Water that we turn around in fairly short order or are able to process almost in due course of day-to-day activities. I guess in order for us to present the kind of detail you're looking for, we would need to go in and break out the specific types of authorizations. In some cases, we're talking about easements. In other cases, we're talking about leases. And in other cases, it's the processing of temporary water uses or the adjudication of water reservations and water rights applications. So,
all right, we'll use the example of asking for a tideland permit to put in a dock and tie it to the land. Or you can bring that information back to me. Like I say, 2011, they told them 5 years. What are they telling them today? My question, I guess.
We'll bring that back to you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I read it right, so on page 25, you left out fire activity, and I'm assuming that you have it on 24. So is it $20 million that we spend on fire suppression? Just trying to figure out why the numbers are different. It's from page 25.
Through the chair, in FY13, I believe the fire season was $46 million, of which 22 was general fund. So that would be close. Yes.
Okay, so since we have an air quality issue in Fairbanks, which I'm sure nobody knows about, and we're always wanting dry wood, $46 million, I mean, I cannot imagine that we cannot have some type of a program in which we are managing our forests versus the other way around. So has anybody, I know we've done studies, besides studies, we don't have studies to wait for. What can we do so that we're not burning as wildfires, which then also impacts our air quality, and we can utilize it for our residents, not just in Fairbanks, but in our other communities that I know also that like to burn wood?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we have a number of tools that we can use to help individual Alaskans obtain firewood. We also have, in certain instances, safety programs to go out and thin out the forest near communities of interest. I know we do that out in the Tok area in particular. In the interior, we have the Tanana Valley State Forest the authorizations to go out and cut wood locally are limited by road access primarily. Many of the fires that eat up considerable resources are ones that occur far away from infrastructure. It's only as they near town or get closer to roads that we have to get more concerned and really engage in the suppression activities to keep them from actually encroaching on our residential communities and settled communities. So in some cases, the amount we're expending is driven by the proximity to communities, but not necessarily in a forested area that we have under management for forestry purposes.
Follow-up? That made no sense to me. We usually don't put – I'm sorry. So we don't put fires out usually until they are going to possibly endanger a community. And I'm not even talking about the air quality that gets there, but actually does it. So we're talking about areas of the state that somebody could reach, and whether that's forestry. I understand there's permits. I can go out and cut wood in the forest, and I do. I actually have it delivered from other loggers who have it. But ultimately, that's really not a plan. I mean, in Haines Junction, I met some loggers as I put my car back onto the road, and they deliver wood all the way from Haines Junction to Beaver. You know, and they profit when they do that. They even go further than that. So, I mean, there's a market in Canada, and there's a market here, and you guys like to make money, and we like to burn dry wood. So I'm just trying to figure out why those things haven't connected when 20 million of the 46 million, and almost every year we have fires where we have a lot in there, it just seems like we would have to save money if we were being more proactive versus letting the thinning happen because of fire. Am I missing something? I had to make it a question.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the opportunity to plan for that kind of thinning and fire mitigation is driven by ownership of the land in question. So there are certain lands that we own and manage in a particular way. We're governed by the land use planning processes that we have in place. And so if it's state land, we start to have a say. If it's federal land, not so much. If it's private land, really not so much. So where fires start, we don't get to pick and choose. And where they go is a function of the wind. So if the suggestion is that we can go and cut the trees before they burn, we'd have to know where it's going to burn first.
So if I could just get information back for like the last 3 years where the fires have happened and mm-hmm. how many acres have been state versus federal. I know you can't guess where a fire is going to happen. You can pretty much guess where it's not going to because of where it's already burned at. But even in those areas, there's some great opportunity to be able to help solve an issue. I've been trying to do this for 4 years to open up land that is accessible that the state owns so that we can do what the EPA wants us to do and bring dry wood in.
And so TOC is now bringing, we're getting some into Delta, but I think it's an opportunity the state's missing, but maybe all the land that we're burning is all federal. So if you could give me that information, I'd appreciate it, and maybe we need to go talk to the federal government.
Representative Gehr.
Thank you. Commissioner, I've looked at the last two presentations from revenue and from your department, and I haven't seen something that I'm very curious about. In AGEA, there was a provision that said if we canceled the contract, which we have, we would owe TransCanada treble damages, and they've had very sophisticated attorneys. They would probably interpret that as triple the profits they would make over the course of the pipeline, and we would interpret it differently. I don't see any cost for that settlement, and it would surprise me that they would just back out of a very valuable contract with no cost. So did that settlement cost us anything in terms of money? I didn't see anything in the Department of Revenue or in your budget presentations.
Through the Chair, Representative Guerra, as a point of fact, the AGEA license remains in effect. We've pre-agreed to withdraw mutually from the license if certain things happen later this session. With regard to the opportunities to end the license, the question is whether or not the project that is subject of the license, that being the project headed to Alberta, is economic or not. Since inception of the license, when it was executed or signed in December of 2008, my understanding is that the licensee and its partners have spent $430 million, of which we've reimbursed approximately $300 million. The treble damages clause that you are referring to is what is potentially payable to the licensee if the state were to breach the contract and otherwise offer inducements to a competing project. That has not happened here, has not been agreed to in any way that somehow there has been a violation and that we're somehow compensating them for a violation. Frankly, a violation has not occurred. We have not been in breach of the agreement. So there is no need for an appropriation by either department for that purpose.
Through the chair, please. You mentioned that if certain things happen this session, there's not likely to be litigation. Are there provisions in any of the proposed agreements for the gas line or in the bill that we're considering that are in there because of that potential litigation that TransCanada has requested? You said that they are not likely to take action on if certain things happen this session, and I'd like to know what that means.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, what we have in the way of an understanding with TransCanada that's been embodied in the form of a memorandum of understanding between myself, Commissioner Rodell, and the licensee is an agreement to mutually agree to withdraw from the license if enabling legislation passes. So if that enabling legislation passes, then the transition out of the AGEA framework and into the heads of agreement framework will take place. And we will leave the license behind us with no further obligation under that particular contract between us.
I'm going to interrupt you for a second. Representative Gehr, you mentioned the word litigation twice in your question there, and I haven't heard the litigation come from the DNR. I've heard transition out of the current agreement on AGEA, and if the enabling legislation doesn't pass, the contract's still there, but there has to be a project that takes that back into effect of some type, I would assume, and unless the state just walks away from it, and then you get into a litigation issue, I would assume, but I'm not sure whether You're talking about litigation, and I haven't heard that come from you know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My ultimate question is, has there been an agreement with TransCanada that the enabling legislation or any of the agreements that are on the table have to be worded in a certain way for them to agree to walk away from the AGIA license?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I would be happy to walk through the MOU with you offline and explain how the agreement works and what the mechanical steps look like. But I'm not sure what you're talking about with regard to awarding something.
Through the chair, the question is, if we do not accept certain provisions of the MOU or change certain provisions of the statute, are those in violation with the agreement that you have with TransCanada, or could they be? And if they are, I'd like to know what provisions are in either the MOU or in the statute that TransCanada has requested.
Mr. Chairman, I want to defer to you before pulling out the MOU and reading it for Representative Guerra.
I don't need the whole MOU read.
Yeah, there's a provision that might give him some comfort.
Only if it's a single provision in there that I don't want you to read the MOU, no.
Yeah.
So it is in Article 2.1, Part D. Reads as follows: the parties agree to support the approval of the operative terms in the enabling legislation, but acknowledge that the enabling legislation may include authorizations or conditions that vary from or conflict with the operative terms. In such event, and if parties agree to accept the enabling legislation, then the transition agreements will reflect the enabling legislation terms and conditions, notwithstanding the parties' acknowledgement above. What that means in layman's terms is we have an agreement to agree on a set of terms later this year if the enabling legislation passes. If the legislature changes the legislation, then we may or may not have an agreement.
Mr. Chair, I think that's what I was looking for. It sounds like if there are certain provisions, and I'd like to know what they are, that if TransCanada doesn't get, we may not have an agreement, and I'd like to know what those are at some point.
We won't know whether we have an agreement until we have legislation or not legislation. Well, and at the point in time, if my understanding is correct, then the negotiation starts over again.
That's all I need for now, Mr. Chair. We could be here for a long time if I kept going.
I know we could. That's why we're only talking about that one piece. Okay, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Balazs, thank you for your presentation here today. I'm going to change direction a little ways.
Thank you.
The federal government, U.S. Geological Survey, is in the process of publishing new federal maps of Alaska. And being the federal government not recognizing our trails, are leaving out the RS-2477 trails in their new publications. I'd like a comment on that, and is the state of Alaska publishing new maps that will include those RS-2477 trails?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, thank you for the opportunity to speak publicly on this particular point. And while we are disappointed that certain maps that people have been accustomed to using in the past are no longer going to have such trails, we on the state side are, in fact, in the process of publishing some of those revised maps with overlays that reflect the RSTs. And not only our RS-2477s, but also 17B easements that cross ANCSA lands so that members of the public can reach public lands in accordance with ANCSA.
Follow up. By the federal government not publishing these trails, is that just telling us that they're going to continue to fight us on recognition of those trails and our use of them through public lands?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, I am struggling to recall what my counsel's advice on this was. So I beg leave to get back to your office directly on that one.
Thank you.
Representative Edgman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I notice Mr. Fogles isn't in the audience. He probably is among the many casualties of the fog.
Devastated.
Absolutely. Hospital 77, what's the plans with the water rights reservations and potentially adding back in tribes or persons or non-government organizations, as the law reads, I guess, at this point?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, we that particular bill is in the Rules Committee on the Senate side at present. We spent a considerable amount of time over the interim hearing from the public, engaging various interests around three provisions that seem to have attracted the most heat and light. And the one you're referring to with regard to in-stream flow reservations is one that we're trying to match up our objectives with the feedback from the public. Our chief concern is that while persons have been able to apply for in-stream flow reservations for more than 30 years, a provision of statute that was added at the request of placer miners, I might add, who've never actually used them, we didn't see in that course of time any persons apply for reservations until the last couple of years. And we saw it first in the instance of the Chewitna coal efforts out on the west side of Cook Inlet. And in that case, what we observed was a company with valid mining claims was obtaining temporary water use permits in order to engage in exploration activities and otherwise gather the necessary data to complete the NEPA process for that particular project. Residents in the area filed an application for an in-stream flow reservation for 100% of the water flowing through particular streams in the area, and after having filed for that reservation, turned around and went to court to stop DNR from allowing temporary water uses in the area. Our concern was in that particular instance that simply filing an application would have the effect of chilling the use of any water in the aquifer or in the system for a period of 5 years while all of the necessary data was gathered for purposes of adjudicating the request for a reservation. Now, when somebody comes in and makes a request for a reservation, there are four statutory criteria or reasons why we would reserve water and block other uses of that water. So what we were attempting to do was make sure that if somebody's going to apply for a reservation, that in fact you're using a negative power of the state to block others from doing something, we thought that we should do like most other states and restrict it to public agencies. Clearly, that has generated a considerable amount of opposition. And what we are seeking to achieve is a different balance and potentially a different combination of application rights but also holding rights in these instances where clearly somebody's made an application for a reservation, but is that simple act of applying going to stop all other uses for a period of 5 years? I don't know that there is an absolute need to even change the statute, But the statute itself is unclear. It led to litigation in the case of the Chewitna project. We did wind up with favorable decision from Judge Ridner, and he sided with the department in saying, no, an application filing in and of itself does not warrant the stoppage of any other uses in the area. And on the one hand, that's a positive outcome, right? We, you know, could probably get by with that, but it's just a superior court decision. It's not binding, and so it's not going to prevent anybody else from replicating the exact chain of events in some other part of the state. And ultimately, what we need is clarity on what happens when you've got these competing filings, and one of those filings requires multiple years of data and information before we can get to an answer. So conversations are going on with the Department of Law as to how we can structure such a solution. And I am optimistic that we're going to land on an approach and wind up back in front of a standing committee and be able to have a full hearing on another approach to solve the problem that we see in our day-to-day business.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not going to pursue this line of questioning because obviously this could as well take up the entire hearing, but I just appreciate the latitude to ask a question on a subject that has been, you know, outside of Senate Bill 21, probably garnered as much interest statewide as any other piece of legislation. This was my one opportunity to pose a question to the commissioner, probably on this subject. So I appreciate the response, and I'll pursue my interests outside of the committee discussion.
I'll pick up on it a little bit, though. So the application on the Chewitna for 100% usage of the reservation of the water, does, in a normal situation, if it's not warranted, does the department say no, well, we're not going to issue that permit and deny it, or do they come back and say, okay, 10, 15, 20%, whatever reservation you need for whatever you're talking about is granted?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The I think you've got it right. So when somebody makes an application, the answer may come back different than what they applied for. However, if we were to spend the initial period while the data is gathered acting as though 100% was reserved for fish, we would be blocking otherwise perfectly valid or otherwise okay uses of water. So we need to have the opportunity to take a look at the data, evaluate the science, and make a good decision that will, in fact, make sure enough water is preserved in the system to support fish or any of the other three statutory criteria.
Did the Chewitna Coal Company apply for the first water right and was using them?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that they had applied for temporary water uses. When it comes to the use of water, you have non-permanent and permanent. If you have a well for your home, you're going to want to get a water right. That's something that's permanent, records against your property. If you don't have one, get one. In the case of the Chewitna project in Pac Rim, I believe it was a temporary water use that they had sought. And I think there are probably some other longer-term considerations that will come up in the course of their NEPA process for the full mine permitting. But in order to get out into the field and do some of the data gathering necessary to support that application, you need to have some water use in the field. So it's one of these chicken and the egg deals where they needed to be able to use some amount of water just to get through the permitting process so they could have a longer-term prospect of using water.
I'm like Representative Edgemont. I think I'll have you in my office at some point in time for a specific conversation, you and Ed. And
look forward to that.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you give us an update on the review of the dredge and fill permitting authorities that we authorized you to move forward with last year?
Through the Chair, Representative Munoz, thank you for raising that particular topic. It's one that we are eager to pursue to completion. And what that legislation authorized us to do jointly with DEC was to consider whether or not applying for and obtaining primacy on those 404 permitting activities is actually a net benefit to the state. We know there will be costs. We also recognize multiple benefits with that. And the fiscal note associated with that legislation authorized a certain number of positions. We have, I believe, two of them in the Office of Project Management and Permitting. We have filled those positions. We've executed an MOU with the Army Corps of Engineers and EPA in order to assist us in gathering the information we need to competently evaluate the opportunity. And I have to say that our engagement with the local commander for the Corps has been incredibly beneficial, very constructive, there to answer our questions and provide what we need.
Can I have one more question? What will be the time frame then for reporting back with recommendations on whether or not the department takes over the authorities formally?
With the Chair, Representative Munoz, I believe that we would be coming back in 2016, possibly sooner.
Representative Gehr.
Thank you. Commissioner, just on, you had mentioned that until recently, very few people had applied for water rights. But the other way that we can protect an adequate level of water in our fishing streams is for the state to do a reservation to say we need a certain amount of water in this fishing stream. My understanding is the state has done that on very few fishing streams. So can you tell me how many streams the state has done that on, if you know? And if I'm accurate in saying the state has not done that on the vast majority of fishing streams in the state?
Through the Chair, Representative Guerra, the conversation earlier was about those reservations specifically. And we have adjudicated the in-stream flow reservations for a large number of streams and rivers in Alaska, primarily and especially those targeting our king salmon. They're not all complete, and I would dare say that the ability to fully adjudicate the necessary reservations for fish in every stream in Alaska is a process that would require an incredible amount of manpower and resources. I will be happy to give you the most up-to-date numbers, but my understanding from Director Goodrum is that in 2013 we adjudicated and completed reservations on more streams than we had in the 20 years prior. So we're on the job. We're getting after it. We can only move as fast as the data comes in the door.
And just so I make sure I understand, Mr. Chair, there are two ways, as I understand it, for water to be reserved in a stream. One is for a private party to come in to do it, and one is for the state to make a water reservation. I was just asking about the ones where the state has come in to and is that what you were referring to? And then how many streams was that the state did water reservations for in 2013?
Through the Chair, Representative Guerra, a reservation is a reservation regardless of who applies for it. Historically, reservations have been applied for by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or the Department of Fish and Game or some other public agency. It's only in the last 5 years or so that we've seen individuals or non-public agencies come in and file for said reservations. I believe, if memory serves, the number of reservations that were completed last year were in the neighborhood of 20 streams. We will get you the hard numbers in writing first thing next week.
Thank you. That's 20 streams, and that's more than all the prior streams. So the total, I guess, in state history is somewhere around 40 or less. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, we can get you the full history on that.
Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Is it public information, the names of the organizations that make these reservations, applications?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, yes.
Could you give us a sense of some of the organizations that, for instance, applied to the Chewitna project or to the river?
We'll be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Further questions for the commissioner?
Well,
Representative Edgman.
Yeah, just one comment. And for my fellow committee members here, this is why my region has such concern with this bill. It's that so many very sensitive water bodies in the highly productive Bristol Bay watershed area have been cataloged or have been measured. I think you did a good job responding to the question, but I think your answer was a little bit more bullish than I think the actual percentages would show if you laid it out region by region throughout the state. And so I just want to put that on table, that there's in the Bristol Bay area, for example, there's a lot of active salmon-bearing streams that have not been reserved or have not been measured, and that at some point could be in conflict with larger development projects. So I want to just put that out on the record for now.
And through the chair, Representative Edgman, I appreciate the distinction between salmon, and I hope that I used the word king salmon. Certainly, sockeye are a huge part of the fishery in the Bristol Bay region, but the king salmon fishery in that particular region doesn't extend in all the same places as the sockeye.
Okay, seeing no further questions, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr.
Mayor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So that's it for today. We will again take up the department overviews on Monday at 1:30 with the Department of Military Veterans Affairs and the Department of Environmental Conservation. With that, we are adjourned.